SJR-15.
Back in the battle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rick Metzger?
I'm aware of the rules, but we have a clock going.
Good.
And we have a gong going.
Good. What's our limitation, Mr. Chair?
It's a gun.
It's a big fire. Two of my wads away. Mr. Chairman, Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 14, on Senate Joint Resolution 15. You know, there was some material that was passed out the last time, and I don't know if you still have it in your file, from Senator Clarno, who was unable to be here today, as co-sponsor of the bill. You may have some comments from some others, and either Paulette Pyle from the Food and Shelter, or Mary Botkin from Ask Me, and if not, I will kind of cover some of those territory. Senate Joint Resolution 15, of course, is a referral to the voters regarding the initiative referenda process. And very succinctly, Mr. Chairman, it says, should that process, whether referred by the legislature or brought to the ballot by the citizens, should the decisions respect the will of the voters? Do the votes of the citizens actually count? The initiative system does two things, I believe, that are critical. Number one, it provides access to the ballot for citizens. But number two, I think it puts a responsibility that their vote actually has some meaning, that their vote actually does count. We have seen a number of times in this body, for those of you that were here, for example, Measure 47, which was passed and had to be reworked because obviously the voters wanted to pass 47. While there were some problems with it that this body found, reworked that over for Measure 50. Currently, Measure 7 has passed the voters. It's been ruled unconstitutional. The House has already formed a committee to address that issue, and the reason is clear. But even maybe unconstitutional, the voters have clearly expressed a desire that something needs to be done. And the legislature is referring, is working on an issue that may ultimately amount to another referral to the people so that their voice is heard. Measure 82, as you might remember, the gas tax increase, actually ended up on the ballot, was soundly defeated. And yet we are here this year, and there is no gas tax increase. As you know, that will be referred to the voters after their voice was clearly heard. Now, one might make the argument that we could put something else out to the voters that doesn't refer to weight mile or others, but to the voter it would still be certainly substantially similar. And that is that they have spoken clearly at this time, and because of the political dynamics of this building, we certainly do not want to throw something out to the voter and tell them their vote doesn't count. That happened once before in this body, as you know, with assisted suicide. It was we asked people to vote on it again, and an emotional issue such as that changed dramatically in terms of the vote, and you can't believe that people's opinion on assisted suicide, Mr. Chairman, changed at all, but they were incensed by the fact that the legislature didn't seem to listen to what they had said. This is different to the initiative system. We continue to see votes, the people casting their vote, and yet because of the business nature of the initiative system that it has brought upon us, that those votes are not important unless those votes are in favor of the proponents. If those votes are no, the will of the voter is not important. The message they are sending is not important. And that is clearly articulated by the fact within days of this last election, proponents of measures turned down by the voters were saying they were working to put them back before the voters once again. What SGR 715 basically says is we kind of have a term limit on initiatives, whether that is brought to the voter by the citizen or brought to by this legislative assembly. And that is respect the will of the voters. If they say yes, obviously we have to implement. If they say no, we should also respect that and give them some breathing room before those things are brought before the electorate once again. I would use an example. If either one of us or to stand for election to the Senate and lose, you know, it'd be nice we could say next year, gee, I'd like to run for the Senate again, but we have a term limit for that, and the term is 4 years, and it's going to be 4 years before we can come back and make that case again. What SGR 15 does is say exactly the same thing, that you have to sit out an election cycle before you bring back something substantially similar to the voters. What has happened in our initiative system now has become a business. Obviously, those, and the majority of those initiatives come from just a very few of those businesses, aren't concerned about the result of the voter. They're concerned simply about the machinery of bringing things to the electorate. They hop on that initiative Ferris wheel, and if the vote is no, there is no consideration that this is important. They'd rather put the electorate and those who are opposing those measures through that same rigor once again. I think we need to be respectful of the outcome, whether that is yes or no. I think all of us have heard from our constituents concerned about the vast growth of the initiatives either referred to by us in the legislature or brought forth by the citizenry. And I think it contributes to the fact that the voter believes that their voice is not being heard. And I think whether they vote yes or whether they vote no, that is insignificant. And I think that is a critical aspect of this. Within days, as I mentioned, this last election, a number of issues that were thumped by the voters were announced that would be bringing back again. Some of these have been back 3, 4, and 5 times. Now, there was a comment made by Mr. Sizemore 2 hearings ago on this general topic, and I wanted to touch on that, Mr. Chair, before I finished. And that was...
You have run out of our time.
Okay, well, let me conclude then, Mr. Chair. This refers both to the legislature and through the individuals through the initiative process. I think it's a real question is, do we want people to have a voice? Do we want to respect their vote? And is this something that we believe the voters would like to vote on? And I believe they would. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Miller.
Are you taking questions?
We will take questions.
Thank you. If this was drafted as a statute, would it be constitutional?
No. My understanding was from Mr. Rettlinger draft, it had to be a constitutional amendment.
Can you tell me what provision of the Constitution it would have violated?
I would defer to your, you know, learned judgment on that, except for the fact that it is an amendment to the initiative process, which is in the Constitution.
Okay, it would be probably Article 1, Section 8, which is the free speech provision.
Yeah. It does not violate the free speech provision. If, as opinion of legislative council, if that's your getting at, Senator Miller.
Drafted as a statute, this would.
Oh, that would be likely, yes. I was told it had to be constitutional, yes.
Right. Otherwise, it wouldn't make it. Just one thing, Mr. Chairman, I wanted to share this with the committee just by because our staff did such a fine job of this.
Do you have copies?
I'd be glad to provide them for you. And it has to do with the notion that whereas we should, I'm sure, as you've suggested, respect the will of the voters, I wanted to ask a question about the initiatives and how many of them have been approved just looking back for the last 10 years. In the last 10 years of 416 proposed initiatives, 24 have passed, less than 6%. So the question is if I'm still, in a variety of bills we've had proposed here, I'm still looking for the problem.
Well, I think you articulated it, Senator, very well. They haven't passed, so many of these, and so many of them have not passed 4, 5, and 6 consecutive times. And I think that's the issue. People have spoken on it, and they've said no, and they continue to come back and force those who were opposing those who thought they had made a case with the voter and have been asked to have to make that case immediately again.
But is the suggestion you're making that democracy can't handle the debate and therefore we've got to shut it off and we just can't allow this discussion to take place every 2 years?
Well, I don't think it's a matter, Senator, about having the discussion. And again, I would talk to my issue about whether it's running for the Senate or the political environment in which we are in. We can have the discussion about a gas tax, too, but there are political realities that the electorate, I think, expects of us. When they have sealed a decision with a vote, to have some respect for that decision-making process until such circumstances change. But we are seeing initiatives in which there are no circumstances that are visible that have changed other than the fact that someone wants to continually to put people on the defensive. There's a monetary issue here, as you know, whether you're for or against something, to have to fight those initiatives. I think there's the real question as to does this respect the will of the voter if there is not some time frame that is cast upon these initiatives or referrals by the legislature in which the electorate has said no.
Just one other question, if I might, Mr. Chair, just so in case the court should ever listen to this tape, and I'm sure Senator Courtney would help us with this, but the definition is you can't put something out there that is substantially similar. Would you like to define what that means?
Yeah, and we did, Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, work on that very carefully, because it is a difficult issue, and we try to limit that down as to, and there is a definition in the bill of what substantially similar is, and it also points out, Senator, that if in fact the petitioner disagrees with the decision by the Secretary of State that is substantially similar, that there is a direct appeal to the Oregon Supreme Court for a decision on that. If they sustain the Secretary of State, then it would be considered substantially similar or not available, but they could overturn that, in that case an initiative could go further, or a referral by the legislature for that matter.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We appreciate that. I tell you what we're doing. We've got three bills in the middle of this one, two more to go. We've got 19 people signed up for the next 50 minutes. In deference to Senator Trow, we're going to close the public hearing on this bill and have Senator Trow's testimony. We'll be back to it, Dan. We'll come back to it. Nobody panic. But we'll open up the public hearing to get testimony from Senator Trow on Senate Bill 182, and we'll close that, go to 11, get his testimony, then we'll go back and start it again. Finish up.
Mr. Chair, I have two bills, Senate Bill 182 and Senate Joint Resolution 11. Could I do both of those while I'm here?
Sure.
Thank you,
sir. One at a time, though.
All right. Thank you very much.
We'll have to bang it.
Okay. Senate Bill 182 is a bill that deals with a problem we have basically with the initiative process, and that is that sometimes getting through the process are bills that are poorly worked out, and they have constitutional problems or statutory problems or legal problems of violating contracts or so forth, and those bills need an upfront review.
Really nice.
Those bills need an upfront review, and what I'm proposing in Senate Bill 182 is a way of doing that. Now, I know this proposal has been made before, and basically it would ask the Attorney General to do that within 20 days of receiving a prospective petition. And that has not been accepted before. This bill's been around, has not been accepted. I think it's not because there's not a need to do this, but that the belief was that somehow or other this set up a process that would be expensive, would be bureaucratic, and would simply be a tremendous burden on the Attorney General. So what I'm suggesting that we do, and I have amendments to the bill that I would suggest, would be to sort of change the timeline, and also to narrow the scope of this thing so that basically there would not be an Attorney General review unless within 10 days of the Attorney General receiving the initiative measure, the governor or the president of the Senate or the Speaker of the House of Representatives requested such a review. And they would have 10 days to do that. And then after that, if they requested it, then the Attorney General would review a measure, and he would have 20 days to do the review. And then the review would become advisory and would be would accompany the measure. The Attorney General could confer with the chief petitioners as he did this and so forth, but it would call upon the Attorney General to make review. My guess is if you had this kind of process, if you had an upfront screening so that you had to get an official request by one of these officials to do this, that you wouldn't have them happening too often, but that you would have them happening when they're needed. And then the Attorney General would have 20 days to get it done. That would just add an additional 10 days. It would give you a process of an upfront advisory screening of these measures so that you could find whether or not there are constitutional or legal problems related to them. Now, we've had, I remember Measure 8 a few years ago that was thrown out by the courts later at great cost, the cost of an election and everything. Measure 7 this time, again, that we just had, all the time and energy that went into it and the expense of running the measure through the process to have it basically set aside by the courts. It would be better if we had an advisory opinion up front so that we knew that there were problems, and I think that would have a beneficial effect. And I think you can do it without creating a huge burden on the Attorney General if you have this upfront screening that would be done. The President or the Senate or the Speaker would have to make a request for it to be done. And so I think that's a way that you get at it without creating a huge expense. I know there are lots of measures. Many of them don't have a chance of making it through the process. They don't have a chance of getting the signature. So the President or the Speaker or the Governor are not going to ask this be done unless they think there's a real prospect that this thing is going to make it onto the ballot and there's some real problems with it. But in that case, they can ask the Attorney General to do an upfront review. And so I think it's a beneficial measure. So that's the first one, 182.
Hang on a second. Senator Barr.
Yeah.
Thank you. Senator Schroll, have you discussed this with the Attorney General?
I have not directly discussed it, and I know that generally the Attorney General has opposed these measures, and there may be legitimate reasons for the Attorney General to do this. I've thought we've needed to do this, and I think one of the reasons he's opposed it, quite frankly, is that the other bills have asked him to do it for every one of these measures without any upfront screening, so that he would have to do it for a whale of a lot of measures, whether they had problems or not, and that would mean that he would have to institutionalize and almost a bureaucracy to do that. This would mean he would do it occasionally when there was a measure that some responsible public official said there really could be a problem with this one, and we need to have that upfront advisory opinion. And so so that's why I think this is a better way of doing it. I do think I think it's very important that somebody do that. I had a bill a few sessions ago to have the Supreme Court do it. They didn't want to do it either. Nobody wants to do it. There are probably legitimate reasons why they don't want to do it, but I think it needs to be done by somebody who has some clout and somebody that can say to the public, look, there are real problems with this one. And their constitution or their legal and so forth. And maybe that would mean that the measure would be revised, postponed, rewritten later, whatever, but you're going to get a better product if you have some kind of screens.
Mr. Chair and Senator Trow, the reason I asked the question is I think it's a good idea to have a legal opinion, too, frankly, and I thought it was a good idea when I introduced it in 97.
Did you
introduce it? Might have been 95,
yeah.
Too.
Okay.
At that time, in discussions with the Attorney General's office, they had a concern, not with necessarily that there was a need there, but the fact that they didn't want to be in a position as the state's lawyer of putting an opinion out saying we think there are constitutional problems with this, only to have it passed and then be put in a position of having to defend it against their own opinion, you know, in the court later. One of the suggestions that came up during that discussion that perhaps that would be a role as an advisory that legislative counsel could do, they wouldn't have the same conflict.
Right, and perhaps they wouldn't. Maybe if they advised against it, it passed. They had to. I guess they would have to defend it. But I'm saying they could contract it out and let somebody else defend it.
So even the person contracting out would be arguing against the Attorney General's opinion.
But maybe we ought to change that. You know, if they advise against it, then they don't have to defend it or something. I do think you need some kind of good advisory opinion up front on these things. I think it would save the state a lot of money and would be a good process.
Would you be opposed to the notion of having that done by legislative counsel?
I think it needs to be done. If legislative counsel could do it and do it effectively and with the kind of weight, I wouldn't be opposed to that. No, I think I think the Attorney General could speak with a little more authority than legislative counsel. So that's why I think the AG should do it. But you're right, there is a problem there, and I admit that.
Okay, thank you.
That's Senate Bill 182.
Senate Bill 182, and open up the public hearing on this
area. SJR 11 is a simple bill, probably too simple for you to swallow, but I think it's a great idea. Every place I go and mention it publicly, people
simple thing.
Right. People say, yes, indeed, it's too easy to amend the Oregon Constitution. And all you have to do is look at the Oregon Constitution and compare it to the U.S. Constitution, where we have had only 26 amendments over time to the U.S. Constitution, whereas you've had all kinds of numbers of amendments to the Oregon Constitution, and it's a huge, ungainly document with lots of stuff in it that Constitution shouldn't have in it. A lot of stuff that ought to be in the Oregon statutes, but not in the Constitution. So all this does is simply say that if you're going to amend the Oregon Constitution, you need a supermajority. Generally, I don't like supermajorities. I don't like them in the legislature generally. But I do think when it comes to amending the Constitution, it ought to be much more difficult to do. And I remind you that to amend the U.S. Constitution, it takes a proposal by two-thirds of the members of each house of the legislature is sent out, and it must be ratified by three-fourths of the states. Now, you can do it some other ways than that way, but all the time it's two-thirds basically to propose, and it's three-fourths to approve. What we're suggesting here is that rather than a simple majority, when the voters vote on a constitutional amendment, that we say that you need a two-thirds majority of people to vote on it before it becomes accepted as part of the Oregon Constitution. A problem I see with it clearly is that there's already so much stuff in the Constitution that when you make major changes, you often have to amend the Oregon Constitution. This would mean you'd need the super majority to do that. But even so, I think in the long run, it'd be very beneficial. At some point down the line, I think, you probably don't agree with me, but I think some point down the line, our Constitution is so unwieldy and so full of stuff that eventually we're going to have a constitutional convention or something and start over with a new Constitution. Now, you know, I'm silly, as you guys know, but I think we're going to need to do that. Then I think, by golly, we ought to have this two-thirds so that we don't amend it willy-nilly, and that things that the policy changes we want to make, we do it statutorily, unless they really fit the framework of government change, and you change the process or the nature of the government, and it really fits in the Constitution. But just so much of the stuff we do really doesn't belong in our Constitution. That's my belief, and that's why I propose the two-thirds supermajority there.
How about if we put that out, Senator Trobe, but required a two-thirds passage?
That'd be fine.
Would that be okay?
Be fine. Absolutely.
That's the one. I've got some email from somebody here. Well, I thought that was an interesting concept.
Mr.
Chair.
Yeah, Senator Biden.
Actually, Senator Trobe, just putting on your historian side, wasn't there in the middle 60s a proposed revision to the Oregon Constitution?
Right. In fact, there were a number of things submitted to the voters, in whole blocks of changes and edits.
It wasn't exactly a constitutional convention.
No, it wasn't a convention.
It doesn't really do that, but there was a revision, mm-hmm. an overhaul to the Constitution prepared by a Constitutional Revision Committee.
Mm-hmm.
I think spent 4 years on it, put it out, and it was turned down.
Right, yes, I recall that. it's very difficult to do, but I do think at some point we're going to need to do it.
Yeah, we'd agree. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Close the hearing on SJR 11.
Thank you, committee, listening.
Thank you, Senator Trude. We reopen the hearing on SJR 15. Mary Bodkin, Dave Honeycutt, Dan Meach, Tom Cropper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in opposition to SJR 15. The primary problem with SJR 15 is it's unconstitutional.
Yeah.
It violates at least as Judge Lipscomb interprets it, it violates the full text provisions of Article 4, Section 1-2D of the Constitution, because it makes changes to the free speech provisions of Article 1, Section 8, and doesn't incorporate the free speech provisions of Article 1, Section 8 in the text of the measure. Therefore, again, at least according to Judge Lipscomb and his ruling on Measure 7, SJR 15 would violate the full text provisions of the Oregon Constitution. It also
I ask this because I know you're an attorney, Dave. If this was written and referred by the legislature as a revision to the Constitution, that would be resolved, wouldn't it? The legislature has the authority to submit revisions of the Constitution to the voters.
Chair Harper, Senator Beyer, the legislature does have the authority to refer revisions to the voters. They have to pass by a two-thirds majority. This is written as an amendment. It talks about amending the Constitution, not revising the Constitution, and more importantly, the full text provisions, I believe, of Article 4, Section 1, 2D apply to, don't distinguish between amendments and revisions. Hmm. More fundamentally, this violates, and this may answer part of your question as well, Senator Beyer, this violates separate votes provisions of Article 17, Section 1, as interpreted by the Oregon Supreme Court in the Armada case. This makes amendments to both the power of the people to amend the Constitution via the initiative and the power of the legislature to amend the Constitution via the referral. A person may want to vote to limit the power of the legislature to revise the Constitution and not the power of the people via the initiative, or vice versa. A person may want to vote to limit the power of the people but not the power of the legislature. If this measure is at least under current interpretations of the separate votes provisions of the Constitution, if this measure went out, it would be challenged, would violate separate votes, and would be struck down. Ultimately, I think the court's going to go, the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals are going to go different ways on the separate votes provisions. If they don't, we're looking at 43 constitutional changes that have been made since 1908 that are all subject to challenge.
To the bill.
So, in any event, the primary problem with this resolution as written right now is it violates the Constitution.
Yeah, we heard that from the sponsor, too. So. Okay. Thank you.
Dan Meek for the Coalition for Initiative Rights submitted written testimony on this bill a week ago. Just imagine a law that prohibited any legislator from introducing a bill identical or substantially similar to any bill introduced but not passed during the prior four-year period.
Yeah, I said we like that one.
I think most legislators would consider such a bill to be unwise. We take the same position about SJR 15 and its application to initiatives. Senator Metzger indicated that this is to prevent things from going back to the voters four or five or six consecutive times. But he didn't give any example of that ever happening. The only example I can think of is perhaps the sales tax, which the legislature referred to the voters many times, and I didn't hear a specific complaint about that. In fact, every specific example he gave was a referral, not an initiative, with one sort of hybrid example, which was assisted suicide. And he said that we should respect the will of the voter on things like assisted suicide and not have the legislature refer the same thing out to voters again. But his SJR 15 would not prevent the legislature from referring assisted suicide back exactly the same way to the voters again, because SJR 15 only applies to measures that have lost, not to measures that have won. So his specific probative example is a situation that his measure would have no effect upon. I also think this would be a great boon for attorneys in this field in order to litigate what substantially similar means.
Yes, I agree. Thank you. Tom, you're signed up for this one.
Okay. My name is Tom Cropper, Portland, Oregon. I've been involved in two initiative campaigns. One made the ballot and lost heavily. Another one didn't make it onto the ballot. I fought a sales tax referendum, and so I know how the process works. I personally believe in the Coalition for Initiative Rights have voted to oppose this measure because basically the problem that we have here is the initiative process is a basic right. It's a form of free speech. It's democracy in action. And you know very well that the majors that have lost heavily won't be coming back. It's majors that are controversial and close. Those are the ones that will come back. And oftentimes, those are the ones that need to be heard. I personally voted to oppose this, and the Coalition for Initiative Rights voted that way also.
Great. Thank you. Phil Dreyer, Becky Miller, Greg. Okay. He wasn't signed up for or against. Anybody know? No.
I'm sure he would be.
You want me to ask a question?
Go ahead.
Okay. Becky Miller, Oregon Taxpayers United. Obviously, we would ask a couple of questions. Would we also prohibit candidates who fail at the ballot from running for office again for 4 years?
I like that one, too.
or what about those persistent school bond measures that come back special election after special election after special election? We need to be even-handed with this sort of thing. And I think one of the primary targets of this bill is probably Oregon Taxpayers United's paycheck protection efforts that we've pursued now for 2 election cycles and going into the third. We've had 2 variations we've put out to voters on this measure. One of them said you had to get an employee's written permission each year before you could take money from their paycheck for politics, and another version prohibited using public resources to collect money from for the public employee unions to use them for their political activities. Now, I am sure that the public employee unions would argue that those two are substantially similar, but where would you draw the line on that? And let's realistically, the first time we put one of those measures on the ballot, the whole debate was over whether or not we should get rid of the voters pamphlet. We didn't debate whether or not employees ought to be required to give their permission before money could be taken from their paychecks and used for politics. We never discussed that issue. It was all about the voters pamphlet. So we rewrote the measure to fix that issue and put it back on the ballot. And then the debate still wasn't about paycheck protection. The debate then was about whether Jerry's kids would be hurt because charities might have to also get permission from their contributors because they lobby sometimes. So we've fixed that problem and we're going at it again. Now, does that mean that each of these generations of the measure are substantially similar? They are substantially similar, but they are in response to concerns that were raised in the campaign. Let's suppose that that measure 91 on this last ballot, the one that we put on the ballot to allow you to deduct all your federal income taxes on your state tax return, let's suppose that had failed, and so the next time we came up with one that answered all the concerns people had expressed, well, it's too much of a cut, too fast, and so we phased in with a cap on it the next election cycle. Would we not be able to put that on? The big question is what is substantially different, and you really can't define it that clearly.
I get the drift.
Senator Dyer. Just a question, Ms. Miller. In thinking back to your testimony on a previous bill today, where you were describing a friend of yours who disagreed with you on a lot of things but always signed the measures so that she enjoyed the debate and when that. Would it be a good idea to put this on the ballot just to give the public the chance to consider it and vote whichever way they chose to vote?
Chair Harper and Senator Beyer, I think a lot of people have a misconception that you can just snap your fingers and put a measure on the ballot, that it's easy to do. And the reality is you have to have people willing to financially support your effort to put a measure on the ballot. And if you're putting a measure on the ballot just simply to create a discussion, people are not going to give you money for that effort. You just flat aren't going to raise that money just to have a discussion.
Well, that's not my point. My point is this resolution that's proposed here is proposed just to put the matter on the ballot as a revision to the, or as an amendment to the Constitution, to allow people to have the opportunity to discuss it and show their decision on how they would like the Constitution to be.
I don't really understand your question.
It's just, I mean, in the frame of the open debate and chance to vote, putting it on the ballot doesn't necessarily mean that people are going to choose to amend their Constitution. It just means they'll have a chance to debate it and vote on it.
Well, Chair Harper and Senator Beyer, there is one very big difference between measures that go to the ballot through the initiative process and measures that are drafted by the legislature and put to the voters, and that is that when measures go to the ballot through the initiative process, they go through a very lengthy public involvement process to write a ballot title, whereas when they come from the legislature, legislators can write the ballot title to be very favorable to the measure, and it often can bias voters in favor of the measure when if they really understood the measure, they might not support it because the ballot title is worded in a way that makes it very friendly. I'll give you an example of that with the term limits effort. Last session, legislators wanted to loosen the term limits by, and I understand the same effort's going on now, by taking away the provision that a certain number of years maximum in each house for a total of 12 years and just make it 12 years overall. Well, when the ballot title for that measure was drafted, and it didn't go to the ballot, but when the ballot title was created for that measure, it was worded in such a way to make it sound to the voters as if term limits were being implemented for the first time. It said, should we have a 12-year limit on terms? Well, that really wasn't clear to the voters what the question that they were being asked. And my point is that makes it very different. And I don't believe that you really are talking about apples and apples.
Well, so you think that the founders and framers of the Oregon Constitution didn't mean it when they wrote Article 17, giving the legislature the authority to refer amendments and revisions to the Constitution to the public?
Well, Chair Harper and Senator Beyer, I didn't say that. I said that that the circumstances under which ballot titles are written are substantially different. Therefore, you can't say that when voters respond to a ballot title written by the legislature, that is the same sort of a response as the response that they get to ballot titles written through a public process that involves...
You're not questioning the legitimacy, in fact, the obligation of the legislature to refer those matters when they think it's appropriate.
No, I'm not questioning that. I'm saying that it isn't an equal situation and that you shouldn't see it as, you know, well, let's just throw this issue out here for debate. See, when a legislature decides to put something on the ballot, it is not as hard as it is to go out and circulate petitions and get the signatures to put it on the ballot. It's quite a lot easier to do. And so
isn't the end result the same? The debate, you get the same debate, you get the same result. They vote, and they say yes or no.
Well, yeah, as I was saying, the issue really is who frames the question and how is it framed? And again, I do not believe that it is an apples and apples situation if you're going to weigh the value of the debate when the legislature can write a favorable ballot title, but the people through our process do not have that same ability to do so, that the scales are tipped in favor of the legislature's access to the people and in framing the debate, and it's not tipped in favor of the people.
But that's not all you need to
do. Let's any more?
Yeah.
Great. Thank you, Beck.
The only time that I'm aware of something getting on the ballot a number of times before it passed was the Equal Suffrage Amendment, which got 37,000 votes in 1906, 37,000 votes in 1908, not quite 36 in 1910 when they tried to restrict it to tax-paying females only, and finally in 1912 it passed with just over 60,000 votes. So I guess my question would be, you know, should those women have had to wait 4 years? Well, actually, it was men who were doing it because there was no women voters to amend the Constitution in the first place. But sometimes political reality is that sometimes repeated submissions are necessary. And just by way of irony, I guess, I would point out that the same sponsor of SJR 15 who wants 4 years waiting time, also has introduced SJR 11, which asks the people to vote again to make it harder to use the initiative, even though they've rejected those efforts twice in, what, the last 5 years. So,
okay. Thank
and, you. And one, Article 17 is a product of an initiative. The people gave the legislature the right to free throw that amendment, and I think that that constitutional revision you're referring to, the Supreme Court would not allow it to go on the ballot. I think that's how it was ended up, that there was a revision made and the Supreme Court wouldn't allow it to go on the ballot the way that they did it.
Okay. Thank you, Greg. Mary? Second. You're the only Mary I have signed up.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I got hung up downstairs, but I'm here now. And for the record, I'm Mary Bodkin with the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. And we're surprised, and here we're here in favor of SJR 15. Let me just say a couple of things. First of all, you know, I have been the sponsor and the carrier of many initiatives that may or may not have been a great idea. I certainly thought it was a good idea at the time. And we've introduced things more than once, as Ms. Miller has. This cuts both ways. It says, we don't win, we don't get to go back for 4 years. I think that it makes some sense for us to give the legislature an opportunity to act on measures in between ballot measures and initiatives. I think that if we want a full and honest debate on ballot measures, we probably ought to put them through some kind of a public hearing process. You know, I'm open for that, whether they're measures I like or whether they're measures I don't like. I think that they should go through some kind of public scrutiny. I think that one of the things that's making voters crazy is the fact that there are measures being proposed as constitutional amendments that are unconstitutional. You know, most kids in fifth or sixth grade could tell you they're unconstitutional. But we got to go through the whole process, go through the court process, only to find out that, oops, we were right. They were unconstitutional.
Excuse me, Mary.
And I think
this is 15.
I know. And I think that when you defeat a measure, I think that waiting for 4 years is a good idea. It gives you as a legislature an opportunity to act in the meantime. And I think that the legislative process is a better process. I think it allows for more debate. And if debate is what we want, this is where we ought to have it. We ought to have it in this building, not on the streets where you're doing bumper sticker debating, where you may or may not get the straight story when you go to sign a petition. There's no truth in advertising out there. There's no petition cops out there making sure that people know what they're signing or know what they're voting on. And if Ms. Miller doesn't like the way the elections go, then maybe we ought to use the legislative process. I'm open for that. I think the legislative process is a better process to use anyway. Half the things that are on the ballot anymore ought to be legislative, not constitutional. And to be honest with you, as I said to begin with, this cuts both ways. You know, as you can tell by the diversity of the people you've had here testifying on this measure, you've had both the far left and the far right. That must mean there's something in the middle here that's right. And I would say that SJR 15 has probably, you know, gored both sides of the aisle enough that this is probably a really good idea. And, you know, if neither of the extremists like it, then, you know, we probably hit somewhere in the middle and we ought to pass it out and, you know, let the voters decide. Or maybe that's not what people want. Certainly what I would like to do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All right. Close the hearing on SJR 15. Open up public hearing on Senate Bill 182. Phil?
Bless you. Chair Harper, members of the committee, I'm Philip Schradl, special counsel to the Attorney General. In hopes to avoid the gong, I'm passing out written testimony, and I will only summarize it briefly. You are correct in the discussion that you had with Senator Trow that this proposal has been before the body before, and it is also true that our office has opposed it in its current form before. And the written testimony summarizes at least four substantial reasons why we oppose it. There's the resource issue. It would cost approximately, we anticipate, about $600,000 each election cycle to engage in this kind of a review if it is on every proposed summary or every proposed measure. And many of those are increasingly, we see, complex matters that would involve substantial, potential at least, uncertainty about the constitutionality of the proposals. And I think, in fact, in other circumstances, this body has been a little bit perplexed about the circumstance when we have opined that something is unconstitutional, about whether that's the final word on the subject or not. And it potentially, at least, would be subject to subsequent court litigation. And that leads me to my primary concern with the proposal. I was here during Senator Trow's testimony, in which he was suggesting that there could be a screening mechanism with only having requests come to our office if it was screened primarily through the governor's office or the president or the speaker of the House. And it still leaves us with an institutional problem, and that's the last one that's addressed in the written testimony, and that is it puts us into a really an untenable legal position if we are opining that something is unconstitutional. It is nevertheless enacted over that advisory opinion. And then by statute, our office is designated as the one to defend the constitutionality of that statute when it gets challenged. I would suggest that Senator Byers' suggestion about potentially looking towards legislative counsel might be a fruitful avenue to anticipate that you could make some progress there. I don't think that would be faced with the same kind of an institutional difficulty that our office is. With respect to Senator Trow, I appreciate his comments that our opinions may carry substantial weight, but I think the legislative council could do that function as well. I have not talked with anybody from legislative council's office about that, but I would be open to having further discussions with any members of the committee or legislative council's office on that front.
Okay, so it gives you guys personal problem just getting into it like that.
Yeah, as an institutional matter, I think it would put us into an untenable position where we'd be litigating against ourselves or needing to authorize somehow some kind of substitute counsel process, which then would just make us abdicate our statutory responsibility to defend statutes when they're enacted and actions by the body.
Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dan, Meek, Becky.
Dan Meek for the Coalition for Initiative Rights. As a member in good standing of the Oregon Bar, I was prepared to support this measure as it would require the hiring of at least 5 to 10 additional full-time attorneys. I think a $600,000 estimate of cost is probably an underestimate. If you've got, let's say, like in the last election cycle, 200 petitions that you need opinions about, I don't think you can do competent opinions on 200 measures for $600,000. I don't think you can do anything beyond issue spotting, and you certainly could not do a comprehensive or even a credible job on those measures. The suggestions or the changes suggested by Senator Trow, I'd say, would make me oppose this bill even more, because it would make it apply selectively only to those measures that the President of the Senate, the Speaker of the House, or the Governor don't happen to like. I think it would be even worse than having it applied to every measure on a more even-handed basis. Finally, of course, from the perspective of someone who gets involved in the initiative process, having an opinion from the Attorney General that says your measure is constitutional doesn't help very much. It just says, it doesn't really help you, but having an opinion that says that it's unconstitutional would be devastating. So on the whole, this measure, I think, is contrary to the interest of having a vigorous initiative process. Finally, in my litigation before the Oregon Supreme Court, I found that the Attorney General opinions hold up about half the time. They don't hold up about half the time. So you would be faced with a situation where you have to overcome an opinion that, under this measure, would be printed in the voter's pamphlet, would receive wide publicity, when in fact it is not the final word on the constitutionality of any measure. Thank you.
Thank you. Becky?
Chair Harper, members of the committee, I'm Becky Miller, Oregon Taxpayers United. We oppose this bill. The fact is that the Attorney General's opinion is just that. It's an opinion. It's something that would, as Mr. Meek told you, be used extensively in campaigns by opponents of a measure in order to hurt a measure at the ballot. We routinely, every measure we file, we get legal counsel reviewing it thoroughly for constitutional issues before we ever put it into the mix. And we've had, even on measures that before were thrown out, take Measure 8, for example, or Measure 7, both of which were brought up in earlier testimony, both of those measures had substantial legal input and support for. And even take Measure 8, yes, it got thrown out, but it was on a 3-4 decision. And in fact, one of the justices on the Supreme Court disagreed with that opinion and thought that it was constitutional. And Maurice Holland, who's the, you know, dean at the University of Oregon Law School, thought that it was constitutional. A lot of lawyers thought it was constitutional. Reputable attorneys. And yet it was thrown out. The only opinion that actually matters in the end on the constitutionality of a ballot measure is the opinion of the Supreme Court. And it whatever, take Measure 7, Judge Lipscomb's opinion, really, it doesn't matter. And neither does the opinion of the Court of Appeals. What will matter is the opinion of the Supreme Court. And that may or may not agree with the Attorney General's opinion, but many, many very good lawyers already disagree with the Attorney General's analysis and interpretation of Measure 7, as did they when he did an interpretation of Measure 47 that said that it was a tax increase. So, you know, you can't necessarily say that. In fact, one thing to point out is the Attorney General's position is a political position. That person is elected based on party, and that is not the same case with our courts. So you have to face the political realities that that person in that position is going to be a partisan. Whether that affects their judgment or not, who can say, but the point is the perception to the public out there would be that it does. Finally, we already have the system in place where the Attorney General can keep a ballot measure from going forward if it violates the single subject rules under the Armada decision, and that is really the primary problem. This new issue with Measure 7 is really a new issue and an interpretation of the Constitution that goes beyond anything that has been done before and couldn't have possibly been anticipated by the Attorney General or anybody else in advance.
What about the Legislative Council concept?
Well, Chair Harper,
right now that's available to everybody. Mm-hmm. About 50 signatures, I believe, at least. Or, I mean, if you brought it to us, we'd sift it through. Is that something that would be helpful?
Well, Chair Harper, I know our organization does take advantage of that already, and we have had ideas that we've put together run through Legislative Council in order to make sure that drafting was going to take into account things that we maybe hadn't thought of. We do that already. And yes, I believe it is, as you said, it's available to anybody through a legislator or with signatures. So the problem would be if that was mandatory, that you had to take what they said and go with it, whether you agreed with it or not. That could be a problem because, again, political influences can affect that process.
Okay. Thank you. All right, we'll close. And Bill, why don't you guys just stay here, and we'll open up SJR 11. You better hurry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Becky Miller, Oregon Taxpayers United again. I just want to point out to you that SJR 11, which requires a 2/3 vote, to amend the Constitution would itself require a 2/3 vote to pass. because of the voters' approval of Measure 63 in 1998. That one said that any measure that seeks to impose a supermajority must get the same supermajority it seeks to impose. So chances of you getting a two-thirds vote out of the voters on that measure are so slim that I would suggest you not waste any more time and effort on it. But I did want to respond to one...
Excuse me. That's the law today? I
mean,
yes, that is the law. It's in the Constitution. The voters put it there 2 years ago.
Well,
so,
there's not only one good idea, it's the way the law is, huh?
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So, in case you're confused on what I'm saying, we don't currently need two-thirds vote to amend the Constitution. Okay. But I wanted to respond to something that was brought up earlier, and that was this issue that the Constitution is being cluttered with a lot of things that don't belong there. We've reviewed national studies that show that people's view of their state constitutions versus the federal constitution are very different. The federal constitution really is a sacred document that embodies our rights and the basic structure of our government, and all state constitutions are subject to that federal constitution. But the difference between that and our state constitutions is that that is the one and only place where we can place laws and keep them out of the hands of legislators. And I would point out to you, for example, Measure 11 that the voters approved, which set mandatory minimum sentences for certain violent crimes. And now there's a bill introduced this session that would convert those sentences to, the word just slipped my mind, but basically they're optional. The judge could say, well, we won't do the mandatory sentence, we'll do something less. The only reason that that could ever even happen without voter approval or really knowledge at this point is because it was put into statute. Had Measure 11 been a constitutional amendment, we would be debating that much more openly and the voters would be able to really weigh in on that. Those kind of things can happen, and that's why our organization always goes to the Constitution for things of serious importance, which is how we view tax increases. Because that is the only way to ensure that the substance of what the voters approved stays intact and is not subject to political winds. The Constitution can contain, the state Constitution can contain what might be considered a statutory issue, and it isn't some big travesty because, in fact, the state constitutions really do not rise to the level of sacredness, for lack of a better word, as the federal constitution. It's just not the same.
All right.
Thank you.
Dan Meek for the Coalition for Initiative Rights. I also submitted written testimony on this a week ago, indicating that it would require a two-thirds vote of the people to enact this measure under Article 2, Section 23.
Becky?
Yes.
Can you hang on just a second? Sorry.
Okay. Yes. Article 2, Section 23 of the current Constitution states any measure that includes any proposed requirement for more than a majority of votes cast by the electorate to approve any change in law or government action shall become effective only if approved by at least the same percentage of voters specified in the proposed voting requirement. And the second section states that for the purposes of this section, measure includes all initiatives and all measures referred to the voters by the Legislative Assembly. So if you have any measure that has a supermajority requirement in it, that measure must pass by the same supermajority that it proposes for application in the future. So this would have to pass by a two-thirds vote. Still, I don't think it would be a good idea. I think it fundamentally violates the concept of one person, one vote, and it probably could well be unconstitutional under the U.S. Constitution. Senator Trow pointed out that the U.S. Constitution has had fewer amendments. That's really for two reasons. Number one, the federal level does not have an initiative process, so a constitutional amendment cannot be initiated by the people on the federal level. And second, the principle, the federal constitutional principle of one person, one vote, does not apply to the U.S. Constitution. The U.S. Constitution, as Becky Miller has pointed out, is the one document that is exempt from that requirement. That requirement does apply to the states, however, and I believe that this measure would fundamentally violate that.
Thank you. Tom? Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Courtney had a question.
I was just curious, given your statement about the initiative process, and I was taken by protection is remarkable about keeping the laws out of the hands of the legislature. You may say that. I stand. Are you preparing an initiative to abolish the legislative branch of government already? I understand that going to be placed in the ballot for this time.
Senator Harper, Chair Courtney, you're asking me if we would want to abolish the legislature?
Are you developing for the next ballot measure initiative to abolish the legislative branch of government?
Of course not, no.
Well, no, I don't understand why you say of course not. Why don't you go and put a measure on there to abolish the legislative branch of government?
Well, Senator Harper and Chair Courtney, I actually don't take your comments well, but I'll try to be respectful. We have a very deep respect for our republic system of government and see the initiative process as an extremely important branch, check and balance to the type of abuse of power that can come when the other branches get to be too powerful. And we have seen that happen. The people have, this is our government, and we have given ourselves the initiative process as a way to do that. We have absolutely no interest in abolishing the legislative branch at all. It's an extremely important function that we fully support. However, politics being what they are, the fact is that people will try to use the power and authority that they have been given by the people to pursue their own interests out of an elitist view that they know better than the people what is good for the people. And sometimes the people need to be able to step in and say, no, you don't. And that's why we have the process, and I am extremely strong in my support of that process, as well as my deep respect for the system of government that we have.
Tom?
Thanks.
Okay, Tom Cropper, I made a, I don't have to redo it, but I'm a member of the Coalition for Initiative Right, and the Senate Joint Resolution 11 is a major that I made a motion to oppose, and we opposed it unanimously, if I recall right, about 4 weeks ago. And I have a lot of respect for Senator Crowe, but I have more respect for William Uran, the father of the initiative process. I have more respect for the majority of the voters. And I do agree that we need to protect the Constitution. But on the other hand, we have things in the Constitution that I'd like out of there. And you can't have it both ways, apparently. I do not support amending the Constitution by two-thirds vote because this gives a dictatorship of the vote to a minority, a one-third group. I would support something like an absolute majority of registered voters, something like that. So I approve of the goal of protecting the Constitution, but I don't think this is the way to do it.
Thank you. Dave Honeycutt.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney. This reminds me of last week. I think it was the two of you at the end last week as well.
Tough ones.
Yeah. I'm here on Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, here on to oppose Senate Joint Resolution 11 primarily for the simple reason that it's unconstitutional as drafted. It violates the separate votes provisions of Article 17, Section 1. It essentially contains two components: a requirement that anything referred out by the legislature that would amend the Constitution pass with a two-thirds majority, and an idea and a requirement that anything initiated by the people to amend the Constitution pass with a two-thirds majority. A voter may choose to apply that test to an amendment, or a voter may want to apply that two-thirds majority to an initiative initiated by the people, but not to a referral from the legislature. A voter may want to apply that two-thirds majority to a measure
referred out by the legislature, but not to a measure initiated by the people. Under this measure, the voter isn't given that opportunity. So at least as the Oregon Supreme Court and Oregon Court of Appeals has interpreted the separate votes provisions of Article 17, Section 1, this would constitute log rolling and would therefore be unconstitutional if it was put on the ballot and passed. It would immediately be challenged and under current law would be ruled unconstitutional. So I think the legislature would be wasting a fair amount of time to have a debate on something that ultimately is going to be declared unconstitutional.
So we don't want to waste time, don't we?
Where are you on the supermajority?
Chair Harper, Senator Courtney, our organization hasn't taken a position one way or the other. I personally oppose supermajorities on anything. I'm a believer in one person, one vote.
Hey, thank you. With that, we will address the R11 and we will close the hearing or adjourn.